I'm here in Naas and I'm talking to Jimmy Boland. Jimmy, a great vintage car man and loads of cars outside that I'll look at later.
Yeah.
But originally, where did you live and where were you brought up?
I was born in Finstown House in Lucan, which is now a hotel, in 1931. My father and mother had moved up from Wexford. And that time, all the farmhands, they lived on the farm. So we had a house in Finstown from my father was there from 1929 until 1937. When we moved to another farm place, which was Castlebaggot, right next door to Baldonnell. And they, people by the name of Mangans. We then moved to Castlebaggot in 1937. It was another farm place. And it was right next door to Baldonnell. Mangans were the people who owned and they were horse trainers. My father had worked all his life with cattle, so his life was cattle. So he was looking after the cattle at Castlebaggot.
Why did he move up to Castlebaggot?
Why did he leave?
Was it during the time of the land commission?
No.
Or did he buy it by the land?
No, he didn't. He only worked for the farmers. He always had worked for his father. And there was six brothers in it. And they were all waiting to see who would make a move. My father by now was 35 years of age, so he was the first to move out. So, of course, they were all hoping to end up at the farm in Wexford, I'm sure. That was the idea. They didn't like moving out. But he had moved out and got married and moved to live in Finstown. There he looked after the cattle. They were cattle dealers.
And who did he work for there?
Waldron were the people's name. They didn't live there. That big house that's now a hotel was idle. There was nobody in it. It later became, of course, a hotel and is now. It's just changed hands. Jim Mansfield from Saggart now owns it.
But he always loved cattle, did he?
And
farming.
And what happened there was Waldron's were cattle dealers, and they were exporting cattle all the time. So they would buy cattle all over the south and west of Ireland, and they would come up on the train, because Finstown is actually on the railway line. So they would unload them on the station and put them into the fields there, and eventually there'd be enough to fill a ship, and they'd be drove with maybe 50 drovers taking a couple of thousand cattle down to the boats.
So it was a very big concern there.
Oh, yeah. That was a facility that just for storing cattle. Buy the cattle everywhere, store them there till they'd have enough collected for to ship to Liverpool.
And your father's job was
he'd look after the cattle while they were there and organise perhaps drovers and that to take them to the boat.
And he went in 1937.
We left there in 1937. We moved to Castlebaggot.
Oh, yeah.
Now that was a different setup because they had a dairy farm plus horse training. It was a stables for horse training.
All right. But listen, let's go back now to the first bit.
Yeah.
He was there from 1920. Is it 10 years roughly?
No, 19 and 29 to 37, yeah. 8 years.
Yeah,
yeah.
And in that length of time, he was working for the Waldrons.
That's
there.
Right.
And
yeah.
Were you born at this stage?
I was born in 31.
All right.
I remember very little of Finstown.
But what do you remember of Finstown?
Well, I remember them dipping sheep for one thing. I remember that because I remember them the trough where they run them into the water and out the other side. I remember that bit of it, and I remember the house we lived in, and
what kind of a house was it?
We had a nice house in the yard. There were a lot of families living in the yard, in actual fact. There was probably five or six families. And they had an out farm then called Goyerstown, and there was more of the workers living there. And at night, we'd walk two or three fields over there to be playing cards, and particularly of a Sunday night. I can remember those bits.
Yeah.
But then we moved, as I said, to Castlebaggot in 1937, and which was right next door to Baldonnell. So I was an only one. I had no brothers or sisters. And if I wanted anyone to play, we had to go to Baldonnell Camp. And in Baldonnell Camp, there was a lot of army guys lived in the camp with their families. There was maybe 10 houses in the camp. There are still houses there, but this the ones that were there when I remember were are long since gone.
Well, that was a very interesting time to be there, because that was the beginning of the Second World War.
That's right, yeah. Well, we'd have been there 2 years when the war started.
And when the war did start, did you see, were you old enough to remember the...
Oh, yeah, I remember the morning the war broke out. I remember we were at Mass in Newcastle, because it was the first Friday of September 1939. And my mother brought me to the first Friday, of course. We went to the first Friday in Newcastle, and the priest prayed that the war wouldn't break out. But it had already broken out the night before. But communication wasn't that like it is now. You couldn't put the telly on.
Did you remember people spoke about a big red sky? And
I remember the night of the bombing very well. We were then living in Castlebaggan, and of course, being right next to Baldonnell, there was a lot of activity with searchlights and anti-aircraft guns going off, because they were firing on them. I remember that, and I remember mother being standing up in a big window we had in the bedroom, looking out at the lights flashing all over Dublin. And there was one very big day a year when all the children, the soldiers' children, would be invited to a sports day. And that happened. And lucky enough, because I was there, I was in and out, I'd be invited to Baldonnell for the sports day. It broke out, as I say, but I don't remember.
But did you notice the, what kind of aircraft were there? Well, it was in Baldonnell.
Not an authority on airplanes, but there was a thing, there was five or six called a Wasp, a very short plane. And there was a lot of flying then, of course. And also, at the beginning of the war, that's where Aer Lingus had started. And there was one flight a day. It would leave in the morning and go to Bristol and come back in the evening. And the pilot's name was Darby Kennedy. And that was known as the Irish Mail. And you'd hear that going out every morning around about 9 o'clock, and it'd come back about 5 in the afternoon. And there was a woman who had a little shop down the road from Baldonnell, and she used to go and that was her job, clean out the plane when it had come in.
And that used to deliver the mail over to
and passengers, yeah, but it wouldn't take very many. But it did fly people to Bristol every day. And I think they have a replica of it still in Aer Lingus. They used to be there in the actual airport, but they moved, they had a lot of stuff stored out there opposite the pub out there at the airport, a well-known old pub. They had a building there which they had a lot of aircraft in, and memorabilia of aeroplanes, and but I think a lot of it was vandalised.
Yeah. And you were roughly, what, about 14 at the time?
No, at the beginning of the war, I would have been 39, I'd be 8.
Oh, but by the time the war finished...
That was 1945. Yeah. But I was 14, yeah.
Yeah, and in those 6 years, would you have... It was exciting for a boy to be in beside the
it was, but you didn't see bananas, you didn't see oranges for years, and you weren't very well dressed, because you had to have coupons for clothes. Even to buy sugar, you had to have coupons. Things got bad and you wanted money for the pictures. I used to tell my father my ration of sugar, so I was out of money for the pictures. Yeah, maybe tuppence. Yeah. The pictures were fourpence, but you're halfway there.
What was the conversation that was going on with the? You said you went over to the camp. To play with the kids.
Yeah. Well, we wouldn't be any war talk there, but of course every newspaper was covered with pictures of the war and maps of where they were moving, where the front was now. Every other night we'd see these maps on the front of the paper.
Did your father follow it, or were your parents, interested in what was going on?
Not particularly, no. It was all too far away. See, the world was a different place then. Ireland was a little spot. But now, of course, we turn on the telly, you can see Australia, you can see New Zealand. But it wasn't like that. So you had to wait for the paper, and maybe a day or two after the actual event would happen, you'd read about it.
And you were saying that it was a different kind of work for your father now in
yeah, well, he was looking after the dairy then, you see, milking and that, and getting the milk down to the road for the all the farmers that time would have a bench at the side of the road where they'd leave the churns. And then the lorry would come along and the driver would get out and lift the churns from the bench onto the truck and leave the empties there. And that happened every morning. And the milking would have to be done on the milk down at the road by 8 o'clock, because that's the time the truck would come. And that was the milk from the previous evening and that morning. And I remember they putting the churns in the river. The milk that would be milked, say, at 4 o'clock today, the churns would be left into the river to keep it cool. There was no fridges. The river was the fridge.
Where in the river?
The river was right beside the cow houses. Yeah, there was a river went right through the yard. And that they were able to lift the churns down into the river.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what creamery took the milk, do you know?
He was a Hazelbrook. And a man by the name of Benny B, long since dead and gone, he was always, for donkey's years, he was collecting with his truck. He would come every morning and pull up beside the bench, the milk stand, as they called it, a bench, and there'd be two or three churns on that, and he'd leave two or three empties. Big silver churns, I think they used to hold about maybe 12 gallons.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
And so that was the routine.
Every
day.
Yeah.
Every day.
Yeah.
And where did you go to school then?
We went to school at that time in Clondalkin, in the Presentation Convent. And later on then, you had to go to the monastery. The boys left the convent when they were after your first communion, and you went to the monastery, which was up what's now the Monastery Road, up the top of just as you come to the Red Cow, really up that end. And there was three teachers there, and roughly 80-90 children would be in the school. Now I think there's nearly that many schools in Dundalkin. Like it was, and of course, every child knew everybody. Somebody belonged to every family working the Clondalkin paper mills. That was a huge business at the time. You had Weatherwell, the tile factory. You had the bag factory, and then you had Swiftbrook and Saggart. So everything revolved around the paper mills at that time. And they're all gone now.
And were those happy days, those school days, were they?
Well, was it looking back on it, they probably were very...
Was it the Christian Brothers?
It was very different.
But was it the Christian Brothers that...
No, it was the teachers that were in there. And one of them wasn't particularly nice either. They were known. I remember the younger teacher who did, say, first, second class was, we knew him as Mouse, but his name was actually Riley. And the next one was Jack Hassett, and he was known for, we all would reckon he'd kill you. He was terrible. Everyone was afraid of him. And no matter who old person you talked in Clondalkin, they would blame him for not having any education. They were afraid of him. Afraid to go to school and as little as possible. And then the head teacher was known as Toby, but his name was Mr. Ryan. And Mr. Ryan was a very civilized man. But I'm afraid Jack Hassett wasn't.
Yeah. But you survived those days.
I didn't stay there very long. I decided that he'd kill me sooner or later, and I decided to move to Newcastle, which was walk 4 miles. Anyway, I would have to walk 2.5 miles to the monastery. So it was worth it to walk till the 1.5 to go to Newcastle, where Mr. Cleary and his wife taught. They were very good teachers.
Yeah.
I had always a problem with Irish. You know, you'd learn the thing in English, and then you had to learn it in Irish, between one thing and another. And... I finished up when I was about 12 and a half. I left school in Newcastle.
You had enough at that stage.
Well, yeah. Because when the Irish class would come on, I'd be told, Boland, go out and clean my bicycle. Go out and mend a puncture in my bicycle. Go out and oil my bicycle. So I did that. And I had good knowledge of mechanical things such as bicycles. I could fix a 3-speed on a back wheel or things like that. But
is that where your career for the rest of your life came from?
I was very lucky. We talked about Castle Baggett. We left Castle Baggett in, I think, 19 and, it would have been 42. And we moved to a place called Nanger Castle. Mm-hmm. Everything to do with Castle. We had Castle Baggett, and then it was Nanger Castle. And we lived in the yard there again. But there was a bloke there called Patsy Kelly, and he looked after all the farm machinery. And in my mind, he was a genius. He could do anything with the tractors. And that was really influenced me then, because I'd work with him when I'd come home, go out and stay with him in the evenings, working on the tractors. And they had thrashing mills that used to go out and work for the other farmers when I had come autumn, or to be out in the spring doing spring thrashing. But I learned a lot from him, of course. I could be done and have general knowledge. I could drive and everything, because he'd say to me, move the tractor over there.
And you were so young.
I would have been, I suppose, 11 and 12 at the time when I got to know him first.
Yeah. Yeah. And so your love for mechanical devices.
Yeah, it would have started there. Yeah. And even though, if at those times, there was plenty of work for kids with the farmers and for women. They'd be picking the potatoes, they'd be dropping potatoes, they'd be tinning turnips, snagging turnips, ringing mangle, all that. That was all work for young people. And you'd be delighted. You got about half a crown a day. But it was better than going to school, and then you had money for the pictures. Yeah.
So having the few bob in the pocket was important.
Oh, it was very important, yeah.
And where did that take you to then, as soon as you left school and you were finished repairing the bike for the school teacher?
That's right. And I reckon there was a better way. So I got a job in a house, Dean's Rat, which was a neighbouring farm of where we lived. And I was the house boy there for, I think I was there for about a year, when I would set the fires. I would clean out the fires in the morning, set them, wash the potatoes, and potatoes ready for the lunch and everything in the house. And then afternoon, you would go out and give a hand on the farm when you'd be finished. So I stayed at that for about a year. And I got the chance of driving a horse in the paper mills then. In the paper mills, they employed 6 horses. The purpose of the horses was to draw the turf in from where it was stored, about 400 or 500 yards away in a field. And of course, they needed an awful lot of turf for the fires, for the mill, for the big boilers. So I went there in 1945 to drive the horse. The horse didn't belong to the paper mills. They were contract horses. Like normally somebody had a horse and they would rent it to the mill. So in the morning I clocked in Jack Callaghan's horse. I didn't clock myself in.
Was it Jack Callaghan?
Owned the horse. Yeah. Okay. So you went and you took out the card marked Jack Callaghan's horse and you clocked yourself in at 8 o'clock.
Where was Jack Callaghan then?
Well, he worked in the mill too, but he owned the horse.
Oh, just the one horse.
Yeah. And that was a great job, because you had 30 shillings a week. And if you could find grass for the horse, you got an extra 7 and 6 a week. So that meant going to people with gardens, cottages with a garden that hadn't tilled, and saying, could I leave the horse in there tonight for a few nights? I leave him there at the weekend. So that worked very well. And I always had the 37 and 6 to collect, because I got grass for the horse. I don't know how much grass he got, but I got the 7 and 6. And then came the 1st of November 1946. We got four horses got sacked because coal was back.
Yeah.
The war was, the coal had started coming in, and McHenry's were drawing in coal instead of turf. They only needed 2 horses to supply. See, the boilers would be running 24 hours a day. So you had to bring in enough turf in the 8 hours. Six horses were bringing enough turf in the 8 hours to do the 24 hours, because you'd be only on day work. And then you had to bring out the ashes to the dump as well. But when the call came, they didn't need six. Two was sufficient. There wouldn't be as much ashes, number one, and certainly don't only use quarter, 1/6 of the coal.
Where was the coal coming from?
The coal was coming, the coal, I'm not sure what country was coming, but it was being imported at the time again.
Yeah.
The turf, of course, McHenry's were bringing up from all over Kildare and the bogs, and they had a huge stock of it. And of course, in the Phoenix Park, there was huge stockpiling of turf.
Yeah. As well. Was there any coal coming from any of the Irish coal mines?
I don't Castle think there was then. No.
Was there not?
No, I don't think so. Yeah.
But that work was fascinating, and it certainly kept you going.
And we got, four of us got sacked anyway on the 1st of November, 1946. And I went from one factory to another to see if I could get a job serving. Me time I went to Arnie's, I went to Dundalkin Pavements, I went to the bag factory, I went to Weatherwell, I went to the woolen mills in Selbridge, and they were all to let me know. But and then one day I got a mad idea. There was a garage at Newlands Cross, which is now Michael Tynan's, but in those days it was belonged to a man by the name of Andy Clancy, a Tipperary man who had started just before the war there. And I said, would there be any chance of a job serving me time? So he told me he'd give me a week's trial. The wages would be 10 shillings a week, and you'd have to give out petrol on a Sunday, do every second Sunday with the other apprentices. So that was a big come down, but anyway, of course, I accepted. I wanted to serve my time as a mechanic. And I stayed there until 1951. And he had decided to go farming in about 1950. So he didn't want any work in the garage, just to sell petrol. And I had been there for nearly 5 years, so I had known all the customers, and they would ask you to come and do a job at their house. Would you come and do such a thing on my car at the weekend or tonight or whatever? And so I did. And that's how I got sacked anyway. I was caught doing mixers. And that was 1951. The first weekend I was idle, and somebody asked me would I do 2 weeks holiday work for them, a garage down in Drimna, at the halfway house, a man by the name of Tommy Allen owned it then. I did the 2 weeks, but the weekend I was finished there, he said he'd fix me up with a job shortly, but they couldn't fit me in at the moment. I was just doing 2 weeks because some of the lads got married and they were gone on their honeymoon, and I filled in for them. And I noticed an ad for a fifth-year apprentice in Esmond in Balls Bridge. So I went after that anyway, and I got a week's trial there.
Yes.
And the first day I went in anyway, there was a guy there. He was after coming back from the RAF, Mick Walker. Mick Walker was the foreman. So I went in the morning, and he said to me, there's a Woolsey there for a decarbonise and a set of rings. He said, would you be able to handle that? And I said, oh God, yeah. I said, because that's what we did where I was. We did a lot of engine work. So I stuck into it anyway, and of course I wanted to be as quick as I could and as good as I could. And by 5 o'clock anyway, I went to him and I said, what'll I do now? And he said, what do you mean? He said, I said, the Woolsey is finished. He said, it couldn't be. And I said, it is. Well, he said, I'll tell you something, you'll be gone tonight. He said, you won't get a week. There's nothing wrong with that. He said, it shouldn't be done that quick. So he took it for a test drive and he come back. Seems all right, he said. And there was two Chrysler Royals there that were after being bought. Murray's owned at Esmond at the time, the hire driver, the funeral undertakers at Baggot Street Bridge. And he said, one of them belonged to Sean T. O'Kelly, they were after buying it from the state, and the other was D.E. Williams' car at Tullamore.
Oh, yes.
IR 2831 was the number of that. And the other was a ZC8000, which was Sean T. O'Kelly's car.
Oh, what models were they?
They were Chrysler Royal 1938s. So he said to me, bring in IR first, he said, and start on that. That's for a full mechanical overhaul, everything, he said, because they're going on funeral work. They were seven-seaters. They were stretched cars. So I brought in the first one anyway and started on it and had the engine out and that the following morning by maybe 11 o'clock. And I said to him, the front cross member is cracked. I said, oh, he said, yeah, I'll weld that. I said, grand. So he said, get the welding plant ready. And I got the welding plant ready. And he started off welding anyway. And oh, God, where did this fella learn how to weld? I said, because I'd been welding mud guards on trucks and everything because that time you did everything, yep. You know. And in the country garage. And I used to feel, I was going to Bolton Street Tech then, half day a week and three nights. You had to do that in order to serve your time. And the lads there would be telling me, oh, we had a Rolls Royce in today. We had a Bentley in today. And oh, we had an Armstrong Siddeley in and the engine did it. And Jesus, I said, if I ever get sacked, I'll never get another job. Because all we had was sand trucks and back springs, and you'd be out on the side of the road and there'd be a load of washed sand, you're trying to get the back spring out. What a difference to what these lads were telling me. But anyhow, we'd got great experience and plenty of welding, and you had to make sure it wouldn't break again or you'd be on the road. It wasn't as like now, like the boss would give you a thump as quick as he'd look at you. He was as bad as the teacher. He was as bad as Jack Austin. But however, it was no harm because you made sure you would do it right.
Yeah. And how many years did you spend as an apprentice there? Were you there?
6 years was the five and 1 year improvership. Yeah. But you see, I was left at five, so I hadn't done my final exams. Yeah. That you had to do in Bolton Street. But oh, yeah, I was telling you about the welding. So he was welding the cross member, and the next thing he was called on, you're on the phone. So I got in and I welded the cross member. And he came back and he said, who welded that? And I said, I did. Where'd you learn how to weld? He said, oh, I said, we had to do it where I was. It wasn't a case of learning. I said, you had to bloody well weld. So from now on, he said, you'll be doing all the welding here. So but I was there 5 months anyway, when one day I was called up to the office and I said, I reckon I'm going now. I felt there was something funny going on. So they said to me, you're going on a week's holidays. And I said, I'm not entitled to a week's holidays. But he said, we're giving you a week's holidays because you're going to take over Mr. Walker's job for 2 weeks while Mr. Walker's on holidays. He said, you're the most qualified to look after the foreman's job. I'm a fifth-year apprentice, and there was mechanics there, 50 years of age and 6 years. I said, this is going to be funny. I thought that one of them would kill me, but they didn't, and I got on very well with them. And Mick Walker came back on 2 weeks later, and the very first morning I was back, Mr. Murray came down, and the terrible argument broke out anyway, and Mick Walker come up to me and he said, you have my job now, I'm going, he said. And that was 1952, and I was there for another 6 or 7 years.
My goodness, yeah.
I left in 19, and exactly 50 years ago now I left, and I started my own business in Llandochan.
Well, you know, I suppose with the confidence that you must have built up.
Well, yeah, I was very confident I could do what I was asked to do as far as engine work or that. And I had no trouble getting through exams and that because we got great experience. If I'd been in a Dublin garage, a city garage, I wouldn't quart the experience.
But because it was a country garage?
Yeah.
Because you were doing all kinds of
work. Oh, yeah, yeah. And it was a case that had to be got out. It had to be done.
Yeah.
And there's no parts available. Make something, fit something from something else.
But did you feel nervous, working on
expensive
on car. Daniel Edmund Williams' car now, you know, the stretched limo one?
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't feel nervous.
It's a pretty expensive piece of
equipment. Yeah, well, nowadays, of course, the that particular car would be expensive. Worth very little then. Cars were quite cheap. But then wages were very low. Like, I think when I went Esmond first, about £4.10 a week you had.
But there were mostly Ford cars on the road, wasn't there?
There was a lot of Fords, but there was others coming along. Austins, there were a lot of Austins. Of course, Lincoln and Nolans were in Baggot Street. They were importing parts and assembling them. There was no such thing as a car coming in on wheels that time. They were come in CKD, completely knocked down. The body panels came in, the rims of the wheels came in, and everything had to be Irish made after that. The leather had to be Irish. The cloths had to be Irish. The tires had to be Irish. The paint had to be Irish. That was because there was an assembly protection. In 1935, the government gave anyone that invested money in an assembly plant a guarantee of 50 years that they wouldn't allow cars in on wheels. So you couldn't bring in cars on wheels.
And was that a good thing or a bad thing, do you feel?
It was a great thing for the employment. God, look at the number of people that were employed in Britons were doing the Morris. Lincoln and Nolans were doing all the Austins. They had their assembly plants. The Leinster Engineering were making the spark and plugs for them. You know, they made their own spark and plugs. The wiring was made in Ireland, the leather or the Rexane.
And what tannery business was supplying leather to cars, do you know?
I wouldn't know, to be honest with you, yeah. But it was Irish produced.
Yeah.
They weren't allowed to import leather.
And the cars would be assembled in the... where were this...
An assembly plant. Well, there was two or three assembly plants on the East Wall Road. Lincoln and Nolans were there, and McCairns were down there. They did the Vauxhalls. They did Vauxhall, and they did Bedford lorries, and they did Chevrolet cars, because that was part of the General Motor Group, because Bedford and Vauxhall were... O'Shea's and Cork were doing the Opel, and they were doing the Studebaker. Hennessy's were doing the DKW in Cork. Which was a little three-cylinder two-stroke car. You mixed oil and petrol together like a motorbike. Who else was there? Dodge. O'Neill's and Pleasant Street were Dodge. They were bringing in the parts of America. Summerfields were doing Chrysler. They were in Baggot Street, beside Ferguson Tractors, down the bottom of Baggot Street.
Well, and in the 1950s, you know, money wasn't exactly plentiful. And, you had now set yourself up in a business in Clondalkin.
Well,
what year was that?
To start with, once I had started working in Esmond, all the work, I could get enough work to keep me night and day when I'd come home. I could work all night if I wanted to, because there was no garage in Clondalkin. The garage
I served... Your garage was the first garage?
No, but where I served me time, he wasn't doing repairs anymore. He only wanted to sell petrol.
Yes.
But so there was plenty of work to be got if you want what we call nixers then, doing nixers at night. And of course, I was working far enough away not to upset the people I was working for. I was working in Esmond in Serpentine Avenue, Balls Bridge. Yeah. I'm living in Clondalkin, so there was no...
the work you were doing in Clondalkin...
There was no fridge. That's for at night for myself.
Yeah, for yourself.
Yeah.
But you must have worked very hard, day and night.
No, you have to if you wanted to get on it. I'd seen a lot of hardship as we moved from one farm to another. And it was terrible. It wasn't always, the job would be finished, my father would fall out with the boss or something. And the next thing he would get a different job with no house, and we'd be still in the other house, and they'd want you out. They'd be given out every day, you have to get out with a new man come. And I seen a terrible hardship. And my aim was to have a house that they could come and live with me. And I succeeded in buying a house in 1953. I bought a house in Laurel Park in Clondalkin, 37 Laurel Park. And it wouldn't be ready for over a year. It ended up, I got married in early 1955, but the house wasn't ready until St. Patrick's Day in 1955. So yesterday, it was 53 years I moved into my first house.
And did you ask your mother and father to move up?
Yeah, and they couldn't understand living in an estate then, a housing estate. In the meantime, we had moved to Belgard Castle, what's now Roadstone, but that belonged to a man by the name of Captain Maud that time, who used to rear prize cattle and show them at the RDS at the spring show and all. So my father got a job there, and we had a nice house there. My father's health was failing a lot, and he was knocked out a lot with pains in his back and one thing and another, so he was losing a lot of time, and he was getting a bit embarrassed about the whole thing. So I thought it'd be great that they could move to live with me, and they did, and it only lasted for 2 years. They moved back to Exford in 1957. They had a few pounds collected up, and they managed to buy a little farm along with his brother. They went 50-50 in a little farm in a village called Kylanearn, which was near Gowrie. So I moved them back. Anyway, I moved them down. I got borrowed the van and working, brought down their bit of stuff. And I had, by now I was working, I had built a nice extension onto the garage at the house, and I could put four cars in the garage, and I also had doors in the back. When I take out an engine while I'd be waiting for it to be ready, I could push them out in the back garden. But the neighbours didn't like that, and there was a wonderful campaign started. Well, I didn't think it was wonderful because it was me, but at that time you didn't own the ground, your house. It was it was leased to you by the Irish Assurance Company in O'Connell Street. You paid £12 a year, and they you had a lease, you see, which said you wouldn't carry on a business and so on. You wouldn't sublet. All those things were written into the lease.
And how did you get away with that then?
I battled it out from 1955 to 1958. It took them that length to get me into court to get a court an injunction to stop me. And about 2 or 3 weeks before, I had managed to buy the garage. And that was another story. I had spent any money. I had put in all this extension and buying tools and everything onto the garage. I was set up there for life, I thought. But the battle started anyway, and it went on for 2 years. All the neighbours kicking up mortar. There was petitions, there was protests, there was everything. And I was promising the Irish Assurance Company I'd never work there again. So I'd come back home to start on another job. But anyway, it was a case of getting a few bob together to have something, to be able to buy something. But the man I had served me time with then, he had gone bad farming. That didn't work out for him. And he came back and he bought a little garage on the new road, which is only about 400 yards from the other place. And I got it into my head anyway. He wasn't in good health then. And he'd only be there an odd day and he'd be in bed a lot. So because of the way we had parted, I didn't like to approach him. You know, because he'd sacked me for
bad memories.
Yes. Yes. I said, yes. And this is, nearly eight years of a difference. So I thought maybe I'd handle it different. I went to a solicitor and said, "Do you ever write to Mr. Clancy and ask him would he sell this garage?" So anyway, I went to a guy by the name of Roger Green on the Keys, Wood Key. He was a solicitor. I had used him to buy my house. And he rang me in work one day, and he said, "I want to see you." So he said, "This man is sort of interested, but he won't talk unless he knows who's interested in the garage." Now, he says, "You have nothing to lose. Why not tell him?" "See, frig him," he says, "you've nothing to lose." So he told him anyway, and he said, then the reply to that was that he'd like to meet me again. So I went to see him, and he was in bed. He was confined to bed at this stage. He was in poor health. He had a little shop there in Clondalkin Village by now as well. And it was over the shop he was living. And that's where I went to see him. We hammered out a deal that day for £825 for the garage. So I had 550 saved after bursting me boiler night and day. And I went to, I was at that time I banked at the Royal Bank in Baggot Street, and I told him I wanted to lend a 275 to buy a garage. No way. They said, you haven't a hope. Young man, you have a mortgage. You have two young children.
But you had you nearly two thirds of it saved.
Yeah, and they wouldn't lend you
They wouldn't give you the rest.
No, no, they wouldn't give you 275. Imagine what they're doing nowadays. But you see what it's doing to the country. People are burdened, not able to pay back their bloody loan.
Well, what did you, I mean, did you try another bank then?
I decided then that I was, I'd have to give up. And a guy rang me up and he said, a man by the name of Tom Cruise in Tal. He rang me up and I always did his work. He was a butcher and he had a van, he had a car and he had tractors. And he had a farm as well. So he said, the tractor's going very bad. I want you to do the tractor. So I said, I can't because I've nowhere to do it, I said. But he said, you were buying the place in the New Road there. You were buying Clancy's place. I was, I said, I couldn't get the bloody money. And he said, much would you sell a half share in it for? So I thought for a few minutes anyway. I said, 425. Because I reckon I had tools in that, and I was levering a few pounds in that. So he said, okay, I'll go with you.
My goodness, so, that was your lucky break.
Right? Yeah, so the following day, anyway, we went to see. He brought me down to the bank, and we went to see the solicitor, and we asked him to get a contract, and we'd sign it. So that was towards the end of 58, and we started up anyway, and the agreement we had was I would take £12 out every week out of whatever was in the till, and we wouldn't divide the money till the end of 1 year when we'd split the profit.
Yes.
So I put me back into all the work. I couldn't cope with the amount of work I was getting at the time because there was no other garages around. You could work night and day. So then I started off with two other people. I employed two people. One fella to give out petrol, because there was petrol pumps and all on this little garage. And on Ascension Thursday 1959, I just sold his brother, a Morris Minor. URI123 was the number. I'd bought an Esmond, the next hire drive one. And he came in to me and he was terrible drunk. This is his younger brother, Mr. Cruz's younger brother, Michal. And I said to him, God, you want to be terrible careful, you've lost a drink. And that night later, the poor fellow was killed up on the embankment. He struck a wall and the car wasn't too badly damaged, but he was thrown out the door, hit his head off the pier of a gate, and the poor fellow was dead in a few minutes. So he was running the shop in Talla for Tommy Cruise, my partner. So he was terrible upset over his younger brother because he had virtually reared him. His parents had died and when Michal was young and Tommy had reared him. Tommy was the older brother and he was the younger one. So he came to me after a couple of weeks anyway and he said, I can't be involved with you anymore. He said, I have to go back and run the shop, because he used to come down at night and make sure all the petrol that went out on credit was marked down and check the till. So the outcome of it anyway was, he said, I have someone to buy my half. He said, Mr. Jemison at Ferguson Tractors, who was the manager of Ferguson Tractors in Baggot Street, he wants to buy my half and he'll give me £1,050.
Well, I suppose that was another terrific circumstances that led to that. Yeah.
So I said to him, he'd have to buy the two halves. I said, I don't want to go into partnership with Mr. Jemison's son. His son was just coming out of college, and I knew what Mr. Jemison wanted. He wanted somewhere to put the young fella in.
Yeah.
You see. And he was going to be a pen pusher, and there was no room for a pen pusher in this business at the time.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So you could read.
I said to him, look, I said, see, will he take the two halves? So he's decided that he, of course, he wouldn't take the second half because the purpose was to put him in with me. So we he wasn't very pleased that I wouldn't agree to him getting the 1,050 for his half and having this young chap come in with me. So we argued for a couple of maybe a week. You know, saying, oh, freak that and this and the other. And eventually he said to me one night, what'll you give me? I said, you know my situation. I haven't a penny, I said. Because I had to put it into the blooming place. He said, would you give me 750? I would have said, be delighted if I had it, but I haven't got it. You'll have it in the morning. He said, I'm going down to the bank to sign for you. And that man went to the bank the following day and signed a guarantee to get me 750. We took that man to the church on the night of the storm. What was the name of it?
Oh,
in 88, that terrible storm, and all the trees blew down. Hurricane Charlie. That was the night we took him to the church.
He died.
And maybe a couple of weeks after, I got a ring from the bank to know, what about this guarantee for 750? £750 was still there. Did I need it or what? And now, of course, that had been 25 years previous. So the bank, the guarantee was still there. And I always looked after his car after that. And for Mr. Cruz, and of course, he had special concessions then. He had done me such a great favour.
I know, yes. He set you up, really.
Yeah, he did, because I'd never... He helped me out twice. Number one, when I was buying it. Number one, when he was selling it.
Well, so, no, after all... So that's the situation you got yourself in. You owned the garage and things went extremely well.
Yeah.
When did you start getting interested in collecting old cars?
1959.
That's in around
very
the same
soon,
time.
Why? Well, I'll tell you that in about 1953, before Tommy Cruise had got involved with me at all, but when I was doing his work, he said to me once, he said, if I picked you up Sunday morning, would you have a look at a Bedford or a truck for me? He said, there's a truck for sale in Strathan, he said, and I would like to buy it. It was an ex-army Austin. And it had a new aluminium cattle body on it. And he wanted it for collecting the cattle from the fairs because he used to use other people. And he was getting a bit of hassle. They weren't picking them up in the time. But anyway, we went off to see this truck on the Sunday morning in what's now the K Club. That belonged to a man by the name of John Ellis, then an Englishman who had just retired and moved to live in Ireland. And when we looked at the truck anyway, and he brought this truck over with him, and he had a mechanic there that he employed all full time to look after these old cars. The mechanic said to me, would you like to see some old cars? So we must have seen 30 old cars that day, 50 years old, and there would have been some of them even 50 years old then, which is bringing it back to about 1900.
Where were all these old cars now?
In Strathan House.
Oh, he collected them himself?
The K Club. Yeah. He brought them from England with him.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, and he had up to 100 motorbikes at that time. And I remember going back in the car with a man and said, what sort of a mad devil owns all that stuff? Little did I know it'd be worse than him one day. And that influenced me on getting into it. Then I said, wouldn't it be lovely to bring an old car back to life, one that has been out in the haggard for 12, 20 years, 40 years. And I thought about it for ages. And one day, Sunday went out for a drive, myself and another man who was interested in old motorbikes. And we're sitting on the bridge in Strathan. And this vet was going by, a local vet here in Naas, Michael Rowe, and he stopped. And he was into old cars, and he said, we're going off to Cork on Friday. He said, there's a veteran car run on Saturday, and we're going. And he said, I believe John Ellis is selling some of his stuff. So my ears went up. Anyway, this is 1960 now. So I said, we'll go up and see him. So we went up anyway, and there was about 10 cars in this garage he brought us into anyway. I said, I'd like that one. He said, no, that's one of my pets. I'll not sell that. And then I go to the next one. And the one I least wanted over in this corner, we got to that. And I was hoping he'd say that was another pet. But he didn't. I would sell that one. He says, it is £75. And I'll put three new tires and a new battery for you. I said, that'd be a start anyway. And £75, that was an awful lot of money that time, because I'd only been now 2 years in the garage. But I bought it anyway. And on Friday, the following Friday at lunchtime, it would be ready. And in the meantime, I entered it in the rally in Cork, this car. And I brought it back at lunchtime. I collected it on Friday. He was leaving to go to Cork, and this beautiful Zara Franchini thing worked several £1,000 at the time, and he had the other car, his mechanic had it ready, and I headed off in the middle of the night anyway for Cork, because the rally would be down there for 9:30. I think I left at 4 in the morning and drove to Cork, and it used to be in the corporation yard was where the start was. And the first thing I asked when I got there anyway is, Mr. Ellis around? They said, no, Mr. Ellis's car broke down, he won't be here. So here was me with a £75 car. But
and had you restored this car back to its, or did you do any
restoring? No, I didn't have much to do with that. Yeah. It wasn't a good car.
And was that the very first vintage car you ever bought?
That was the first vintage one. And it was a Swift, a 1921 Swift.
And at this stage, was there an Irish vintage club?
There wasn't much happening. There were Cork run a rally the first weekend in June every year. The Leinster Moor Club run a rally in the middle of the month. And Tipperary Light Car and Motorcycle Club in Clonmel run on the third weekend of June. So it meant that time they were still a bit tight on tax. You wouldn't like using an old car if it wasn't taxed. But we used to be able to manage to get the three rallies in with the 1 month's tax. At that time, the first quarter ran from the 1st of January, 24th of March, and the next quarter was the 24th of March, the 30th of June.
And so where did you find the time to do all this? I mean, you were trying to, you had the responsibility of rearing a family, you had your own business with lots of overheads.
Yeah. Well, we were able to get in 16 and 17 hours into the day. So that wasn't too bad, you know. And I suppose I was lucky at running my own business, and we were able to do these things. And my wife was great too. She would do all the messages and collect all the bits and pieces. If there was a breakdown, she'd go off and tow it in. And our mother was living with us, and she virtually reared the trickets, you know. Right. Unfortunately, she died in 1966.
And what about your father then? Was he
my father? After him? My father died in the 10th of June 1960, 3 years after the moving back to Exford. My mother lived till 1986, which is 26 years later, when she was 91 and a half.
Right, so, but she lived with you then, did she, for that length of time?
Latter end, she lived in Llandochan with us, yeah. My mother came back up to live with us because she wasn't able to live on her own, so they wasn't able to look after her.
But go back and tell me about, so did you get involved then in the Irish club? Were you one of the founder members of that club?
I was, yeah. We didn't have a club, especially for veteran vintage cars. The Cork Club was the modern club, but they did this whole Crocs run once a year, which was in June. The Leinster Moor
Club. What do they call it again? The old Crocs?
The old Crocs, they called it that time, the old Crocs run. You'd get sacked now for saying something like that. The other one was Leinster Moor Club was a modern. They were running modern race. They were running the Leinster 200. They were motorcycle and car racing.
And at that time, you know, the Leinster Club and the Tipperary Club.
Yeah.
Was it a closed club. Could you get into it if you were anybody
Oh,
in
yeah. If you
what you
had an
like
old
that?
car, you could enter it, and you had to have a competition license, of course, if you were driving a modern car.
And who were the people? I'm sure that it wasn't a very big membership in the countryside, was it?
Well, Cork was had their own premises and all. They had a clubhouse, a beautiful clubhouse, and they had enough land to have a track on it for the motorbikes and that, for grass track and for trials and that. So Cork would have had a big membership,
And
maybe
where was the
1,000.
money coming from? Was it coming from the members themselves or?
It would have been, yeah, and entry fees from events, and they would buy the prizes out of that, and then there would be money left, of course, to look after. Vernon Mount was the name of the clubhouse, and they ran a bar there, and that was the well attended and well supported. When there'd be a weekend in Cork, Friday night you would normally go down, and they get together, meet all the other competitors, and they'd be drinking all night, leave there maybe 8 in the morning, and then Saturday night again, of course, and then the rally be on Saturday, and then Saturday night the prize given and.
But Jimmy, where were these people? What kind of people were these?
They were mostly in the motor trade. Yeah, a very big selection were in the mind. But there was doctors and dentists and everything involved, solicitors.
And who would take a wreck of an old car and restore it?
Well, anybody will do it now. But that time,
At that time, yeah.
yeah, no, it wasn't. You'd have to really love the thing because there was no end product. You weren't going to get wealthy because you restored an old car. It would cost you a lot more. And even today, it'll cost you possibly more to restore it than it's worth when you're finished. It's better to try and buy a restored one that someone has spent a lot of money and prepared to lose money. You know, they've got tired of the thing.
So, did you have to be an enthusiast, a real enthusiast in those days
Yeah, I
to
did.
take
Oh,
it on board?
yeah, much more so than now. Because, and then, of course, money was very scarce. As you said, how did I do it? You did it from the clippings of tin, as it were. You know, there was no such thing as having been able to spend several thousand buying a nice car to go on the rallies.
But a lot of these old cars, you couldn't get the parts for them.
Yeah, well, that was particularly early stuff. You can nearly reproduce most of it or know a machine shop that will do
No,
it.
but when you started.
Yeah, well, they were there then. Oh, yeah. It was easier then. Like
Oh,
getting,
was it?
oh, yeah. For instance, wooden wheels. Just before you came today, I had someone on to me, where did you get a wooden wheel made? Well, when I started in 1958, 9, 60, there were several people around Ireland who could make a wooden wheel. The tinkers particularly, they
Oh, I
would make
know,
a
yeah,
wooden.
but
But now
yeah.
there isn't anyone making wooden wheels.
Yeah.
Upholstery was no problem. You could get deep buttoning done, beautiful work. Now you have to send them to England to have it done.
Yeah.
Because there's not enough work here for anyone specialised just in
And
doing.
how about the mechanical parts themselves? You know, the
Mechanical parts are more readily available now. There's a lot of companies went into reproduction of old parts, like particularly on popular makes like Bentleys, Rolls-Royces, Lagondas. They would produce batches of
What
stuff.
about a Model T now that you pick up?
Model T is the parts in America. You can go to a show in America. There's one show in Hershey, that's Pennsylvania, every October. And I reckon you could go there and start off, buy a wheel off that guy. And you could drive out that Model T over there before the week be over because you could buy another wheel and an axle and so on. And there's a terrible, particularly for Model Ts, you can virtually buy everything.
Yeah.
Reproduce for them.
Yeah, and you know, did you have cars that were more sought after than other
Oh
cars?
yeah.
What were the cars that were really sought after? Is it the Morgans or the?
No, we're going back to the early stuff, like everybody's dream would be a 60 horse Mercedes, 1903, 1904. That would be everybody's dream. And then as you come up along, Bentley 3 liter, 4.5 or 6.5 Bentley in the 20s was the car to own. Vauxhall 3098 was a great car. Austro Daimlers. There was a lot of cars that they would sort of give you a right hand for.
What cars were those?
Well, the 60 Mercedes, as I mentioned.
What was so special about that car?
Well, it was a car in 1904 that could drive at 70 miles an hour. In 1903, the first of the Grand Prix, we'll call it today, was run in Ireland, not in England. We were the first in the British Isles to have a race like that. That was the Gordon Bennett, which was in 1903, and a Mercedes won it. And it was 325 miles, and the Mercedes won at an average speed of 49.2 miles an hour. So you can imagine what he was doing on some straights, probably 80 miles an hour. A Belgian driving a German car won it. Genazzi.
Well, I'm sure there's nothing you don't know about the vintage
cars. Well, I suppose I'd be a fool if I didn't, after being so long involved and reading books and I go all over the world. I've been all over the world with other people with veteran cars, vintage cars and post-vintage, classic cars. They're all different categories.
What's your favourite car in your collection?
I have a 6.5 litre Bentley, which I've had 40 years. And I wouldn't like anything to happen to that.
Why?
Well, it's special, and it's one of these cars you give your right hand for, a 6.5 litre Bentley. Even a 4.5 or a 3 litre Bentley, they're still very sought after. Like 6.5 litre Bentley went over £1 million sterling 10 years ago. They're back down now to maybe 300,000 to 400,000, but that's sterling.
And would that be more expensive than a Rolls-Royce?
Yeah, it would be. Rolls-Royce is, although a friend of mine in the north of Ireland sold his little Rolls-Royce, a twin-cylinder, 1904, it's the oldest known Rolls-Royce in the world, and he sold it for $3.5 million in December. The 1st of December, he sold it at an auction in London. I was with the chap, and the only reason he sold it is he was a bit hard on the drink and smoking and bad circulation. He lost his leg.
And do you look for provenance with these cars?
Yeah, well, we do, yeah. I'd have cars that belong to Prince Rainier. I have the... I have two cars that came from Rainier's collection in Monaco. I have a Bentley and a Jaguar. The Adjacan's car, of his Rolls Royce, of Lord Sanderson's car, of Lord Derby's car. They were all cars that belonged to famous owners.
And how did you come across those cars? Is it because you were a member of
many clubs? Yeah, and keep in touch. I get all the auction catalogues. They're all sent to me. And to be in the right place at the right time is the important thing.
Have a good nose.
Yeah, oh yeah. You'd smell them a mile off when you're as long out as I am.
Okay, now you got into all of that around the late 50s, 1959.
Yeah, that's right.
And you're at it since. But you just slowly built up a collection. And would you buy and sell?
The only reason you'd sell is that you'd be short of money to buy something you'd prefer to the one that you would let off. So you'd start down to buy that one off. You might be 50,000 short or something. You could get 50 for that. So that's what happens.
Or would you pay silly money for cars?
Unfortunately, I did, yeah. But I was lucky I started early on when they were cheap and I collected them then. And at least I have something to trade off against the others. Like I bought a car off Lord Montague in 1968. That's Montague's a Bewley. But I bought that car in 68. I got him £425 for it. I had a guy rang me the other day who has it now in Switzerland. To ask me about some of its history. He wants to put in the ad for selling it. His price is 300,000 for that same car.
Oh, indeed, yes. Yeah, but
I made the biggest mistake of my life with that car. I swapped it for a Jaguar in 19 and 1988 I swapped it for a Jaguar, because the Jaguars, people were going mad for XKs. And I went out to Florida and drove this Jaguar for a couple of days and fell in love with it and swapped me Bianchi for it, which is the car that's now in Switzerland. There's another car there, nearly the same price, which I bought for $13,000 in 1971 or 2. It's in the same place, Otto Style in Belgium, in Holland. And he's looking for around 300 for that as well.
Well, when you look at as an old car, it was handmade.
Yeah.
As opposed to the cars that are made today, they're all assembly line and they're put together by machine.
And, like, you have to try and see the badge or the hubcap to see what make it's parked beside you, the traffic lights. In the old days, they were very distinctive, you know. You'd say, that's a Bentley or Rolls-Royce, and that's a Jaguar, and that's a Morris.
Or you'd know them a mile away.
You'd know them coming 100. You'd even know the sound of them coming along the road.
But when you think of probably the great carriage builders became great car...
Well, of course, in those days, you only bought a chassis. If you went to new Rolls-Royce in 1910, 1912, you bought a chassis. It was up to you to choose a coach builder. It was up to you to tell him what style of body you wanted. He would give you a book with some body styles, and you tell him that's the body you'd like. There's a very good story told about the King of Belgium. He bought a chassis, and he sent for his coach builder. And the coach builder came, and he said, I want you to put a body on my new chassis. And he said, what style body do you want? And he said, you see the sofa I'm sitting in? I want one back and front, he said. And he built that body. And that there was hundreds of them built afterwards. And they're all known as Roy de Belge. King of Belgium. Roy de Belge. I have a Roy de Belge. I have a Rolls-Royce Roy de Belge. And that's what it's known as. And all the ads will say, Rolls-Royce 1910, Roy de Belge body style, 1914, Roy de Belge.
And Roy de Belge came from the fact that he
the king of,
suggested that he wanted his car built.
Roy de Belge means King of Belgium.
Yeah, Roy. Oh, I see. But he wanted his car built around
the seat. He wanted a comfortable, and he said, this sofa I'm sitting in, which would be something like that.
You big, see, long three-seater.
And he wanted... body the same as the two sofas. And it was christened the Roy de Belge body, and there was thousands of them built. I had several Roy de Belge bodies.
But who were the people who patented the different parts or the different cars and the different...
Well, you see, Rolls-Royce used four or five. Hoopers were very much... Hoopers built for the royal family. In England, they're built on the Daimlers, because the royal family always chose Daimlers in England. And the Hoopers were their main coach builder. H.J. Mulliner was another great builder. There was Freestone and Webb were very nice bodies. But there was maybe 20 great coach builders. One of the finest coach builders in the world was in Summerhill in Dublin. And that was Hutton. Huttons of Dublin.
A what address?
Summerhill.
In Summerhill?
Yeah.
And is there any...
They were Panhard dealers, and they were Daimler dealers, and they were bodybuilders. They were building coaches back, horse-drawn coaches back in the 1700s, 1800s. But they were, their body is very highly regarded, a Hutton body. But Huttons probably went out of business before 1910.
And so they didn't really get much of a chance to build body parts for cars.
When things were very difficult, see, if you have a car now over 30 years old that has free movement within the EC, you don't pay duty when you take it from England. If it's 29 years old, you do pay duty. If it's 30 or 31 or more, it's grand. But going back 1970, I bought a Minerva, a very fine car with Roy de Belge body. And at that time, the first thing you had to do, you had to apply for a license to import a car because of the protection for the assembly. And because you tell them it was only an old car and that you were a mechanic and you were an enthusiast and you would like to bring it back to life, you'd eventually get a license. But that would only entitle you to pay 37.5% of what you paid for the car. You could appeal that then and apply back again, and you would get a license for 12.5%, which I did. But all that took 6 or 8 weeks. You'd have bought a car in England, you're worrying you had it in storage or what. I thought I short circuited once anyway, and I bought this Minerva. And the people I bought, I said, we'll deliver it to Dublin. So they just came over as if they were coming to a rally. But then I wanted to take it to England to do a rally. Now, how the hell did I get back in? Because you'd be stopped. Every car was checked at the custom, particularly if you could ride by now. I got some brass plates made up and put them on the step like the way the coach builder hut in Dublin on each side. I arrived back anyway, and the customs officer said, where's this car from? I said, Irish car, of course. I said, look, hut in Dublin. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
And that was car, one way of getting
that
it.
That is the car that's being advertised at the moment in Holland, and bodied by the famous coach builder Hutton of Dublin. It's still
so it's just because you put those on.
That was to get through
across
the
but you would have loads of stories like that, I'm sure, things.
We could be here till tomorrow.
But just tell me the most important part of being a collector. What is it? You know, there are just very few of you, I'd say, that would have collections to the extent you have them.
Yeah, there is very few of them. I suppose having... We have open days, several of them every year, and we've even had a coach load of people come all the way from Manchester to see my cars. And that was nice. That gives you some repayment for all the hardship and struggling that you had getting them, and that's important. I'm now president of the Rolls-Royce Association, and that's worldwide. I'm the Irish president. I've been president of the IVVCC done my 2 years there. I've been on the board of directors for 40 years. So we've had a lot of little things. You know, we got a lot of respect for the old cars.
But it's a labour of love, because you couldn't possibly... I'd say if you had to sell your cars in the morning, it would be break your heart.
Oh, yeah, I'd rather sell the children.
Well, I don't think so, but I mean, it's extraordinary. Yeah,
we've been invited for several things. I opened the bridge, Westlink, isn't it? Westlink, I opened that 20-odd years ago with a car. I opened the new strip of road at the airport with Bertie O'Hearn in one of my cars. Last Monday, yesterday week, I opened a new piece of road here. I opened the M7. Opened the M9, because I always get asked for a car to do that. You know, the first car on the road was a Rolls-Royce 19 or whatever. Yeah.
And so the collection you have is something. What about your own family? Are you going to pass it on to them? Or?
Well, it'll automatically happen. Yeah. And hope they will be looked after. But
is there an interest in your family? Is your son...
Well, they know their cars all right, but I suppose they're still struggling getting off. They've all sort of their own business going, and it's been tough enough, and most of them have their families reared now.
Yeah,
have 9 grandchildren, and one of them is 32 years old recently. So,
and in looking back in all of your life, you worked hard. You worked as hard as your father, I'd say.
And I got a bit more satisfaction. He didn't get a terrible lot of satisfaction, because at least I got the chance of working for myself and having something. If a bad day and things are going again, you can go out and look at the cars and say, well, I have them.
Yes.
Give you a bit of a lift.
And your collection is a treasure. It's a national treasure.
It's
lovely. You know, when you consider that, it's all worth... it's worth the hard work, isn't it?
And I'm still not dead. A lot of fellas did nothing and they're dead. Now I went to school with. They didn't leave anything. It's not going to be easy going off and leaving them either.
No, I'd say not.
But there's no option.
But what a great legacy, though.
Yeah.
Jimmy Boland, thank you. Thank you for telling me your story.
You're welcome. I'm sorry we haven't a lot more time, but there is more stories.